This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you're listening to KDLL Adventure Talks, about the trials, trails, and travels of Kenai Peninsula residents. This month's adventure is a grand float. 14 people, 5 rafts, and 24 days on the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. Tonight at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center, KDLL will host a slideshow presentation with some of the 14 people who did this trip in February, including Sally Tachik, Bill Holt, Mary King, and many more. They'll have photos, movie clips, stories of the trip, and a question and answer session. This morning on Adventure Talks, we've got the guy who organized the expedition, Bill Schwager of Soldotna. Now, the Grand Canyon is one of those trips if you're an outdoors person. If you're a rafter, if you're a hiker, if you're a backcountry camper, this is one of the ones you dream of doing. It's not an easy trip. This is remote, backcountry, whitewater rapids, no cell phones, no way to bail and just drive home partway through. You are out there for weeks to a month at a time. But it is on everybody's bucket list. And usually when people say bucket list, that's a colloquial term. But in this case, it can be kind of accurate because people have actually died on the list waiting to get one of these permits. So, Bill, what is this process like? What does it take to be able to raft through the Grand Canyon?
It is definitely a difficult process. They hold what they call a weighted lottery. And this came about maybe 8 or 10 years ago now. I don't remember exactly when. But prior to that, one would sign up on the wait list, and when your name got to the top, you got to go. At that point 10 years ago that they got rid of that system, the wait list was over 20 years long. People were dying before their name came up on the list. It just became totally unworkable. I actually know of people who, during divorce proceedings, contested who got their wait list slot. It was a very valuable thing to have because they were so hard to come by. So roughly 10 years ago, the park system went to a weighted lottery system. And what that means is if you haven't been on the river for 5 or more years in the section between Lee's Ferry and Diamond Creek, you get 5 chances in the lottery. If you've been down within the last, if you were down 4 years ago, you get 4 chances. And 3 years ago, 3 chances. And if you're down last year, you got 1. So it increases your odds if you've never been there before. And the idea was to get more people, more different people on the river rather than the same people going all the time. Because those who like to do this obviously would apply all the time. And if they had equal chances, there would be more of them winning.
Are commercial vendors, the guided trips, are they in the same boat, as it were, as the private trips when it comes to applying for permits?
The commercial people have their own concession permit, and they are allowed to do whatever that permit says. That being said, the commercial season only runs, and I'm not going to be really exact on this without looking it up, but I believe it's around the first or the middle of April until the middle of maybe the end of September. After that, during the winter months, there are no commercial trips on the river. It is only private trips. When there are commercial trips on the river, there are lots of them. And lots might mean in the neighborhood of, 6 to 10 launches per day from Lee's Ferry. So you see lots of people on the river, and it creates a lot of competition for the available campsites. A lot of the commercial trips are quite large, and I don't know whether you've ever seen these boats. They have huge 35-foot, four-hull motorized rafts that some of the commercial companies run through the canyon. And they've got 30 people on them. Obviously, they take a very big campsite. So during commercial season, you simply have to live with a medium to a small one because they get all the others. It's just the way it is.
What's the timeline for applications?
The main lottery is held every year at the end of February. They open up the permitting process the 1st of February, and it's open for about 3 weeks before they close it. They hold the lottery in the last week of February, and then they notify everybody. If you've won or if you lost, you're notified either way. during this lottery, they open up all dates for the year, and the lottery is for the following year. So the lottery that was held this past February in 2017 will be for next year's floats on the river, not this year. Most people are already planning their trips.
When you're applying so far in advance, do you have to have all your people lined up and ready to go? Or can you just throw your name in the hat and fill out the rest of your party later?
When you apply for the lottery, you can either apply as an individual, and they strongly recommend that when you apply, you have an alternate on your application. This is the only time that you can put an alternate on your trip.
What's the alternate for?
An alternate trip leader, or for lack of a better word, an alternate permit holder. And what this does is if you win a trip and for some reason you can't go, if you don't have an alternate, the whole trip is canceled.
Ooh, no margin of error there.
If you have an alternate on your application, you may then transfer the permit to the alternate and the trip can go forward without you.
Well, that's a lot of responsibility for the person on the application. You must be there or you ruin it for everyone.
This is absolutely true, and they check. The park ranger, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but the park ranger will check everybody's ID, just like airport security. And if your ID doesn't match the name on the list that he's been given, you're staying home. If you forgot your ID and you left it in your hotel room, you get to stay home. So they take it very seriously. They want to make sure that the people that are on the river are ones that haven't been there before. You are allowed to be on the river once per year in any way. If you're going on a commercial trip, that's your once. If you're going on a private trip, that's your once.
So you'd better choose your date wisely is what you're saying.
The way that works, when you submit your application, all dates of the year are open. And they're all listed individually on the application sheet. You can pick any day you want. You get five choices. So you pick your first choice and you put it in line number one and the second line number and all the way down to line five. So if you're lucky enough that your name is drawn in the lottery, they will look at your first choice. If that date is available, you get it. If it's not available, they will look at your second choice. And if it's available, you get it. And on down the line, if you miss in five tries, they throw your name out and they pick somebody else.
Do you register for the length of the trip as well, or just the put-in date and you get done whenever you get done?
The length of the trip is determined by the time of the year that you go. During the high season summer months, you get 14 days in that piece of river at most. You can go less, but you can't go more. If you're in the shoulder season, so let's say 15th of September to the 1st of November, or the 1st of March to the 1st of April or something close to that, I can't remember, you get 21 days to make the trip. And if you're during the winter, you get 25 days. And they give you these extra days because hours of daylight are shorter. You can't spend as much time on the water moving downriver. During the summer, you can probably be on the water, let's say, 8 or 10 hours a day if you want to. During the winter, you're probably going to get a maximum of 7 or 8 hours between dusk in the morning and dusk in the evening, and you really don't want to be pushing it that far. You don't get as much time to move on downriver, so they give you more time to do it.
Okay, so you've got your name, your alternate, and your dates figured out. What then?
So you made your application, you've been lucky enough to win the lottery, and hopefully you were smart enough to put an alternative on there, because sometimes for various reasons, work-related or health-related, you can't go, and then everybody that you contacted to go on this trip with you is now out of luck as well. So if you have an alternate, then the trip keeps going.
How do you actually submit an application?
To apply for the lottery, you must set up an account with the Park Service online. And it's mandatory that it be online. You can't do this in person. You can't do it over the phone. It has to be online. And it simply lists your profile, your name, and your contact information, and nothing more. But it gives you a number that Park Service assigns to you so they know who you are, and it makes it easier to track what you're doing for all these various trips. Once you have your account, you can then apply for any lotteries that are open. And they're only open for short periods of time. The main lottery is open for 3 weeks. That's the longest one of the year. If they have dates not taken in the main lottery, or turn back to them for various reasons. They will hold supplemental lotteries to assign those dates. And at the end of everything, all dates for the year are taken.
And what kind of fees are you looking at for the application process?
When you make your application for any lottery, your first lottery of the year, regardless of whether it's the main lottery or a supplemental lottery, it costs you $25 for the year to put an application in. With that $25, you can also apply for any other lotteries that are open that year if you don't win the first one that you apply for. So if you apply for the main lottery and you don't win, the next lottery might come up in March, who knows, and it'll only have maybe 10 or 12 dates on it. You may apply for that with no further cost, and that will apply to all future lotteries within that calendar year.
Okay, $25, not bad, but I'm guessing that isn't the end of the fees. What's next?
So let's say you win. If you win the lottery, they will notify you, and you will have, I believe it's 3 or 4 days, to make your initial deposit for the trip. If you don't make your deposit within the specified time, you lose your permit. The deposit is $400, non-refundable. And what that covers for you is the first 4 people on your trip. For every person that is included on the roster for your trip, you owe the Park Service $100. And I want to say 90 days before your trip commences, you will be asked to submit to the Park Service a list of the people that are going, and they will subtract out the $400 you've already paid them and give you an amount due for the remainder, and that you must pay or you lose your permit.
Again, with losing the permit, that seems to be the go-to consequence.
They have great incentive here. You're either punctual or you don't go.
How many people can be included on a permit?
It depends on the permit that you get. They have large groups and they have small group permits. A large group permit allows you to have 16 people on your trip, not 16 beside yourself, 16 total. They also have small group permits, which are 8 people. And generally, trips like that are like small kayaking trips, or maybe you only got 2 rafts that you're taking down. You only got a couple of friends you want to take with you, whatever the reason. But there are certain days that they have small launch trips. And you have to apply for that. If you apply for a large permit and you win it, you don't have to take 16. You could just as well take 3. But if you have an 8-permit trip, you cannot take 9.
And did your group do the 8 or the 16?
16. 8s are not available for every date of the year. But the application will always list exactly what dates have what permits available so that you know whether you're applying for a 16 or an 8. But whatever one it is, you're only applying for one of those. You can't apply for both.
How many of these trips have you done now?
I just finished my 3rd one, and I have been very fortunate, very lucky, to be able to win permits when I want them. I pick dates I think I can win, and dates that you can win are always going to be in the winter. If you don't want a winter trip, you simply have to accept the fact that your odds of winning are not very good. Somewhere in the nature of 500 to 1 to 1,500 to 1, depending on the day. That's just the way it is. A lot of people want to do this, and the audience is international. It's not just domestic people that are looking for these trips. This is a world-class whitewater trip, one of the 10 best trips in the world. So a lot of people are interested in doing this.
Given how popular this is and how many permit applications are submitted, is there a way to increase your odds? Like if you can be flexible in dates, does that make your odds a little better?
The Park Service publishes statistics of how many people apply for any given day of the year. And I study those statistics, and I pick days I think I can win. That being said, if you want to go in the popular times of the year, and popular times are like, the really popular time is the month of October. If you want to go in then, the odds are 1,500 to 1 against you. 1,500 people will apply for that one day to launch on the river. If you want to pick on a date like the 2nd of January, maybe nobody applied. It's cold, it's dark, and not a lot of people want to deal with that.
Well, okay. Cold and dark by what standard, though? Arizona or Alaska?
It is a common saying among the river folks on the Grand Canyon that during the winter, the river belongs to the Alaskans because it's like our summer. It's not that cold. I mean, it's 60s during the day and maybe low 40s, high 30s at night. It's not that cold compared to what we're used to. You see a lot of Alaskans applying for the winter times.
What's the difference going in the winter versus summer? The water level doesn't actually change much, right? Isn't that regulated by a dam?
You're exactly right. The river is controlled by the Glen Canyon Dam. The water comes out of the dam, the bottom of the dam, at about 45 degrees. In the best of times, it will warm up 1 degree for 20 river miles. So if you take a 200-mile trip on the river, and the trip is about 225 to Diamond Creek, the water is going to warm up at 10, 11, 12 degrees maybe. You add that to 45, and it's still pretty darn chilly. If you go in the winter, it's probably not going to warm up at all. It just stays cold in the 40s.
What about the volume of water?
The volume of water is dependent almost entirely upon electrical generation demands. In general, flows on the river are between 10,000 cubic feet per minute and maybe 18,000 cubic feet per minute. And that's pretty much year-round. I mean, it varies not only on a daily basis, a monthly basis, but an hourly basis. And believe it or not, they actually published tide charts for the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon so that you know if you're 80 miles downriver from the dam when the peak flow is going to be or when the low flow is going to be so that you can plan accordingly.
And what are you planning for? What's the variability mean for rafting?
Whether you want to run this rapid at a high flow or a low flow, whether you're camping and you want to make sure your boats are pulled up high so they don't float at night because the river's coming up, or you check them during the night so you can move them out so they don't end up high and dry in the morning.
Huh. So that's kind of like tides. I wouldn't think a river that's controlled by a dam would have that much variability.
It's interesting because a change of, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 cubic feet per minute, depending on where you're at in the river, depending on how wide the river is at that point, might change its elevation by a foot or two. And a foot or two is enough to make your draft go dry, and that's not something you want to see happen. You see a 1,200-pound boat sitting on the rocks or in the mud, and you have to find a way to get it back in the water. Not fun. So all this information is available.
This is Adventure Talks on KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And I'm talking to Bill Schwager of Soldotna, who organized a rafting trip down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon in February. Later today at 7 p.m., several members of that expedition will be sharing photos and stories from the trip. So that will be a lot of fun to hear how it all went. But right now, we're talking about how this kind of trip comes together. Okay, Bill, so you've applied for a permit and were lucky enough to get one. Now what?
Now you've won. Now you've got to deal with the logistics of making your trip happen. You've got to invite people on your trip that you want to take down the river with you. And above all, you must have at least one person on this trip that the Park Service considers a qualified boatman, that being their term, qualified boatman. And what that means is if the person with sufficient experience on this river or similar rivers, that you have the competency to read and run this type of rapid, that you can do it safely. It doesn't mean everybody has to be that way, but it means at least one person on the trip must have those qualifications. It is highly recommended that you have at least a somewhat experienced boatman for every boat that you're going to be taking on your trip. So if you have five boats, you need five experienced boatmen. If you've never rowed a raft in your life, it doesn't mean you can't row on this trip, but you shouldn't have primary control of this boat through the major rapids. Because the rapids are big, they do require skill and maneuvering, and if you go into bad places, you can get seriously hurt or worse. It's not a river to be done lightly. It does require experience. So you have to include people on your trip that have these skills. What you cannot do on a private trip is to hire somebody with these skills. On a private trip, everybody must contribute equally to the cost of the trip. If that doesn't happen, you'll be banned from the river or life. It's designed to be a private trip, and a private trip is participatory in nature. You cannot hire people to do this. Trying to find three or four boatmen doesn't sound like much of a challenge. I assure you it can be. Because of the length of the time these trips take, 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks, it's hard to find people that can take that kind of time off, that don't have other commitments to family, job, whatever. So it takes a lot of effort that way to find the appropriate people so that you can have a good and a safe trip.
And was your party able to come up with enough experienced rowers?
Oh, yes. We always manage to do that. Sometimes it doesn't happen for 6 months that I finally find the last person, but in the end, we always find enough. And I've never, believe it or not, taken the same person down twice. Amazing. You always find enough other people that would really like to do this that find a way to make the trip happen. Like I said, the hardest part is finding people with enough time. The cost is not prohibitive on a private trip.
How much are you in for, in all, to do something like this?
I do these trips as a fully outfitted trip. You just show up and go. When you're done, you give it back to them. They get to clean it and put it away and all that kind of stuff. So it makes it very easy. To make that happen for a 16-person trip, you're probably looking in the neighborhood of $60 per person per day, which isn't bad. The trip that we just completed, we had 14 people signed up, 13 went. And the cost was about, let's say, $1,300 a person for the trip, maybe $1,400.
That's really not bad. I mean, if you compared this to a vacation with a car rental or hotels or RV rental and parking fees, I mean, this is kind of a screaming deal.
It's a very reasonable price trip. But to put it in perspective, if you were to go on a similar commercial trip, you signed up to go with Arizona River Runners or some of these other Oars or some of these other big companies. 2-week trip during prime time, $5,500 per person.
Wow.
And I'm not joking. They're extremely expensive. So against that, and you got maybe $1,500 plus your airfare in it. It includes all your food, all your transport, everything except getting there and the things that you bring with you. It's a very reasonably priced trip.
Let's get into the gear side of things. What do you bring and what do you get through the outfitter?
The outfitter that I use is Canyon Rio. They're in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And they're one of many, I would imagine.
There are a handful. I can think of 2 others off the top of my head, but there may be more. Because not everybody uses an outfitter. And the outfitters do not take trips on their own. They're simply supplying gear for the private sector. And since these trips are so long, you have to have a lot of gear because you might have several trips on the river at any one time. It's not like one trip comes off the river, you clean it up and give it to the next one, because you'll have other people in there that also need gear. So they often have 10, 12 sets of gear. And this gear is, wow. I would say offhand, for any given trip, you're probably taking $20,000 worth of gear down the river.
Oh, so you're driving basically a brand new borrowed car down the river.
Between the boats and the kitchen and the food and the safety gear and the toilet gear and all of that. So they've got a fair amount of investment there. And therefore, you don't see a lot of companies doing this. In general, there's only one private trip per day that launches. With very few exceptions, that's true. So there isn't a lot of business out there, and not everybody uses them. Particularly people down here in the closer to the Grand Canyon would use their own gear if they had it. It's cheaper. It's a lot more work because there are specific requirements, specific gear that the Park Service requires you to have. And if they don't approve it, you can't go. So you got to be really careful to make sure you have the right gear, enough of it, so that when they inspect your gear before the launch, and they will do that, they will check everything that's on their list that they want to have on the trip to make sure that you are complying with the regulations. As an example, it sounds somewhat trivial that everybody needs to have a life jacket, but the trick is you have to have an approved life jacket. And approved means it must have the word whitewater in its rating. If you show up with a life jacket without that, you're not going on the trip. So it really behooves you to pay attention to the regulations and that you abide by them.
What other regulations are there?
They do not allow fires on the beach. You must have a fire pan with a fire blanket under it. You must have approved toilets, because all toilet material must be carried out with you. You do not bury it on the beach. You do not throw it in the water. So the rules are very specific, and not everything that's on the market will qualify under the park regulations. So I think to be safe, I would always outfit the trip because they know what the regulations are, and they essentially guarantee that you get all the right stuff, and you don't have to worry about that.
And I would imagine coming down from Alaska is cost prohibitive and space prohibitive. A lot of people around here have their own rafts or paddles and camp gear and coolers and whatnot, but getting them on a plane or truck and getting them to Arizona would be a little challenging in time and space and cost.
Or to drive down. It would take, when we go to the put-in or get taken in off the river, we generally have, I don't know how big this trailer is. It must be at least 30 feet of a gooseneck trailer. I mean, it's a lot of equipment and a lot of weight. Imagine trying to pull that down from Alaska and what that would cost. It just doesn't work.
What all do you get in a rental package, and what of your own do you need to bring?
I'll start by what do I bring on my own. You have to bring your tent. You have to bring your sleeping bag. You have to bring your clothes. And you have to bring your camera, medications, personal items of that nature. That's it. What the outfitter supplies, boat, all the gear that makes the boat functional, oars, blinds front and rear, all the coolers for the food, all the bags that contain other things that keeps them confined to the boat. They supply all the kitchen equipment, all the pots, the pans, the stove. They supply all the spices. They supply all the food. And in Canyon Rio's case, you go through and design your own menu. You can either make up your own list, or you can pick items off of their pre-existing list that you want to eat each day. They will go to the store. They will buy it all. They will repackage it on a daily basis, so you're not hunting all over everything trying to find the ingredients for a given meal.
Wow. I wish that service were available in everyday life.
Well, I've never run out of ice on a trip, regardless of whether the trip was 2 weeks or whether it was 4 weeks. We always have ice at the end. They do an excellent job of preparing all this and repackaging it so that everything fits and it's very organized so that you can find it. We have fresh produce for the first couple of weeks of the trip. You have dairy, you have fruit, you have fresh meat. It's just wonderful. On a long trip, obviously towards the end, you can't have all that because you can't keep it that long. But on the short trips, meaning 2 weeks or less, there's virtually no limit to what you can have.
And not to be undelicate here, but in talking about what all is provided for food, what is provided for the waste end of the food chain?
They provide all the toilets. And if you're not familiar with what that is, you know what the military ammunition cans look like.
I do.
They're metal and they've got this flip up top. Well, this is what we use for toilets. And then they have a special lid that has a toilet seat mounted to it. And you use that for your toilet, except for peeing. You must pee in the river, or you pee in a bucket and you throw it in the river. But all of the solid material we carry downriver with us in approved manner, and then give it back to them, and they have machines that wash all these out at the end of the trip, which they do, by the way. We don't.
Well, that's a service I'd happily pay for. What else are you renting?
They provide all the safety gear. You have a satellite phone. You have the required signaling devices, the mirror and the colored panels, the throw line, so that you can, if somebody falls in, you can get them out of the water quickly. They provide everything else except the few items that I mentioned in the beginning. It's very inclusive, and everything you need is there, including some things you will probably not use, but it's there if you need it.
What about clothing? What do most people wear when rafting? Are you in just outdoors clothes, or are you in wetsuits or dry suits?
That's a really good question. There's a lot of variety there, and it depends a lot on the time of the year. During the winter months, it's probably advisable that most people wear either a dry suit or good splash gear. And splash gear is something specifically designed for whitewater use. It does not mean your best rain gear. It's designed to seal at the necks a little bit and the wrists so that when you get splashed, not if, when that wave goes over your head, you don't get soaking wet.
That sounds damp and unpleasant.
During the warmer parts of the year, most people are out there in t-shirts and shorts. I mean, the water might be cold, but the air is unbearably hot, often over 100 degrees in the bottom of the canyon.
Ooh, 100 degrees?
Much warmer there than it would be even out in the desert. It just, those rocks just soak up the heat and give it back, and it's just an oven down there. It can easily break 130 on really hot days. So another good reason to go in the winter.
Yeah, temperatures in the 60s versus hundreds sounds much more tolerable.
So apparel varies a lot. In general, it's dry. You're not worried too much about rain, but that's also a seasonal issue. The canyon is in a desert area, generally doesn't get half, maybe an inch of rain a month if it's lucky. But that being said, it could all happen in a half an hour. The wettest months are during the summer, August probably. You get a lot of thunderstorms, which will cause not only a lot of water, but possibly a lot of flash flooding as well. But during the winter, it does rain. It seldom snows at the bottom of the canyon. It doesn't say it can't, but it doesn't do it very often. But the rain is cold. One night on this last trip, we probably took the best part of an inch of rain, and it was in the 30s. It was cold.
Ooh, yeah, chilly.
While we got that much rain on the bottom of the canyon, the rim took 2 feet of snow, and you could see it the next morning when the clouds went away. And that was around the 1st of March, so it can happen. You have to bring varied clothing. I guess that's the best way to put it, because it could be warm, even during the winter. You can have warm days in the 60s or 70s, which is quite warm in the sunshine, but a fair amount of the time you're in shade because the canyon walls are very steep and very close to you. And in the shade, it's much cooler than it is in the sun. When it's really warm, a lot of people just fall in the river, get wet, get cooled off. During the winter, you don't do that. You do your best to stay dry. So winter trips, dry suits, something to keep the water off of you. During the summer, the water feels good, so you like to get splashed. So it varies a lot. It depends on the time of the year, how comfortable you are with the cold water. A lot of it's just personal preference for clothing.
How carefully do you pack? When you're backpacking, you're pretty selective in what you choose. Do you have to be as weight and space conscious for this?
Bring lots, and the boat doesn't care. It has a lot of capacity. It can take a lot of weight. This is not a backpacking trip. If you think you need it, bring it.
It sure sounds like the volume of gear is fairly large. All those rafts, all that food, all that gear, and then personal items on top of that. That sounds like a lot to be dealing with.
No, you're quite right there. But by and large, things that come off the rafts for camps each night and have to go back the next morning is your kitchen. We have 3 tables. We have a massive tarp that the kitchen must be set up on so that you don't drop crumbs on the ground. And the tarp gets washed in the river when we pack up the next morning. It keeps ants off the beach, and ants bite, so you really don't want them there.
No, that sounds rather unpleasant.
Everybody will have a personal gear bag with the clothes that they're contemplating changing out for that night, or maybe two. You have your tent bag, or you might be grouped with somebody else because these bags are fairly big. You might get 2 or 3 tents in a bag, depending on how big they are. But that's usually what happens. You spread that out over 4 or 5 boats. It's not all that bad. 1 toilet comes off every day. Every camp will usually last for 3 days or so before it's full. So although it seems like a lot of gear that comes off when you have 16 people moving it and there's only a handful of bags per boat, it's really not that bad.
And can you rent your gear anytime? Do you need to do that well in advance, or can you call a week before you're put in and get everything squared away?
You cannot do it too early. You can do it too late. If I win a trip in the end of February, I've already notified Canyon Rio by the 1st of March when my date is and some idea of what I want. Not necessarily an exhaustive list of everything, but I'm on the list that I get the gear and it covers most everything. the things that may not be totally specified might be sleeping pads. They supply a very high-quality sleeping pad if you don't have one of your own. Not everybody has dry bags, so they have a good supply of those that you can rent from them for the trip. Life jackets, camp chairs, those would be the most common things that might not be totally specified out when you make your initial request for a trip. But the things that will be held for you at that point are your boats and the kitchen and all of that kind of stuff, all the big items that might be in short supply.
And I'm assuming the outfitter hauls all your stuff down to the river and picks you up when you come off.
As part of the outfitting package, I always include that. It would be somewhat of a nuisance to try and do it any other way from Alaska. So they take us to the put-in. They help us rig the boats the first day because most people have never rigged a raft before. So they're putting things in a manner that keeps the raft balanced. And if for some reason the boat were to turn over, everything stays in the boat. So it's all got to be strapped in, at least two straps through everything in different directions so that you don't lose things if accidents happen. And since most people haven't done this, they help get this process done correctly the first time. They stay with us overnight. They give us breakfast the next morning so we don't have to get our kitchen out and cook. And once we leave, then they go back to Flagstaff and we go down the river.
How do you coordinate the takeout? You have a landing destination, but as far as knowing when you're going to get there, is that prearranged or do you give them a call when you get done and they come meet you whenever that happens to be?
You have a set date, which you must be to the takeout or the end. If that is going to change, you've got to get your sat phone out and call them and let them know what the situation is, because otherwise they're going to be there. And it's not an insignificant trip for them. It's 5 hours one way. So you will get charged extra for that if you don't tell them. And sometimes things happen where they can't get to you, and you need to communicate with them as to exactly how you're going to get off the river at that point, whether you need to keep going down, whether you need to wait where you are, because they know what's happening on the land side that you've been totally out of communication with for 2 weeks. So that doesn't happen very often, but the biggest problems occur during the thunderstorm season, the monsoon season in August, because the road to the takeout is literally in a creek bed. And if that creek takes rain, obviously you can't drive it, and the road gets washed out, and they've got to rebuild it a bit before they can get in. So it's just something that might happen. You need to keep in the back of your mind as a trip leader and make sure that the day before you're going to take out that everything is as you think it is. Place a call on the sat phone, talk to them, and make sure everything is good.
Okay, we are going to take a quick break. This is Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We're talking with Bill Schwager of Soldotna about what it takes to organize a rafting trip through the Grand Canyon. He and 13 other people from the area did that trip in February, and they'll be talking about it tonight at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. So come to that to see pictures and video clips of the trip. And stay tuned to hear more from Bill about the logistics of putting this kind of a trip together. We'll be right back. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and you are listening to Adventure Talks, stories of the trials, trails, and travels of Kenai Peninsula residents. This month's adventure is rafting down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. 14 people from the area did that trip in February, and they're going to share photos and stories from that trip tonight at 7 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. Right now on the show, we're talking to Bill Schwager of Soldotna, who organized the trip. And it's one of those where the logistical work ahead of time, getting the permits, the gear, the planning, the timing, is a little more challenging than doing the trip itself. In the first half of the show, we talked about permits and gear. And when we left off, Bill, you were telling us about how you need to launch at a certain day, according to your permit. And you also need to get off the river on a certain prearranged day. But along the way, how much reservation is required for landing spots on certain beaches and campsites? Do you have to set all of that ahead of time too, or do you have some flexibility to stop and camp where you feel like it?
There are no reserved campsites. There are campsites reserved for specific purposes. Some trips have participants who will not make the whole trip. And the most common place for that to happen is at Phantom Ranch, which is directly below the Grand Canyon Visitor Center on the South Rim. And so some trips have people that walk in there and join their trip. Some groups have people that walk out at that point and leave, and some have both. So there are certain campsites reserved for groups that are making that exchange because you need to get to Phantom Ranch as early in the morning as possible so that your people that are walking out have all day to make this 5,000-foot vertical climb out of the canyon. It's not an insignificant hike. It usually takes at least 5 and oftentimes 7 hours one way. And if you got people coming in, it takes not quite that long, 5 to 6 hours to come down. So that the close campsites are reserved for groups doing that. Other than that, all other campsites in the river are wide open.
What do you look for when picking a campsite?
You want to pick campsites that are adequate for your group. Some are designed for very small groups. Some are designed for very big groups and everything in between. If nobody else is around, you can pick the monster ones if you want, so everybody can spread out and have their own acre to themselves. And that's generally the way it is during the winter because there's only one group per day that's being launched on the river. So you very seldom see more than one or maybe two groups in your whole trip. And you might go days on end and not see anybody because you're all moving at the same rate. It behooves you if there are other groups moving on the river at about the same place that you are to communicate with them and see what they want to do. And you can tell them what you want to do so that there is no conflict over campsites. In general, groups do not share a campsite. In an emergency, all bets are off. And you're certainly not committed to any schedule except your exchange day at Phantom Ranch, if you have one, and the day you take out. If you don't want to go real far one day for whatever reason, it's raining, I don't feel like going any farther, you got a nice campsite, you're free to take it. And you can simply make up your time on another day. And if you have several days in front of you yet, it's not that hard to do because you simply won't get to do a hike or something that day, and you'll go the extra couple miles and you'll be back on schedule again.
About how far do you go in a day?
The biggest function of that is daylight. To break camp in the morning, one generally will spend 2 to 2.5 hours from the time you get up until everything is put away. During the winter, that means it gets light enough to see around 7 in the morning, and we try and be in the water by 9:30. I always like to camp at least, be in camp at least an hour before it gets dark.
And what time does that happen?
In the winter, it gets dark around 5:30. So we're looking to make camp at 4 o'clock or maybe even a little earlier. So that being said, during the winter, you've got 2.5, 6, 7 hours maybe that you can be on the water to make whatever distance you want to make. And subtracted from that are any activities, because this trip is way more than just floating down the river.
Right. You are in the Grand Canyon, after all. You might as well stop and explore some of it.
It's the access to the side canyons that you have no other way to get to that makes this trip very special. There's some just absolutely beautiful things to see in the slot canyons. So you try and arrange to see as much of that as possible, and that cuts out your trip from your travel time. It takes a little planning there to work that out so that at the end of the trip, you're where you want to be. The other thing that influences a little bit in certain areas of the river quite dramatically is the speed of the current.
How much does the current vary?
In general, most of the river flows at about 2.5 miles an hour, but there are areas that flow down around 1 or a little less. And obviously, you don't go as far in a day in the slow portions of the river as you do in the fast. And if you do a little research, you can find out where those areas are and kind of plan your trip accordingly. So on the slow days, we might make 10 or 11 miles a day during the winter on this last trip. On the fast days, you could make 20 or maybe more if you really want to put some time into it. So it does vary a lot. You simply have to go with what the river gives you and what your intention is as far as side activities.
When you're done and off the river, do you have any paperwork or permit requirements, or do you just go on about your merry way?
Well, you go on about your merry way. As far as the Park Service is concerned, as long as everybody makes it off the river, you've got nothing else to do. If you have accidents with injuries, there is official paperwork to fill out in as to regards to that, and it must be turned in within 2 or 3 days. It's not very long. If you have gastrointestinal illness in the river, if you're not clean washing hands and things like that, people get food poisoning, they want to know about that. And so there's more paperwork to be filled out.
What about for the outfitter?
As far as the outfitter is concerned, we give everything back to them. Most outfitters would like a post-trip report as to what went well, what didn't went well, and suggestions for improvement, things like that. All trips will have a damage deposit, which the outfitter will hold in case you break an oar, in case you lose something. They will re-inventory all this stuff back into their warehouse and deduct from your damage deposit any damages or losses. And they'll either issue you a refund if you have excess, or they'll give you a bill that you damaged more than what they've already held for you. And sometimes that happens. But that's really the only post-trip things that need to be addressed as a trip leader.
Are there other schedule things to be aware of?
I never allow people to depart for other destinations on the day we get off the river because it's somewhat of an unknown. Things can happen, and you may or may not make your connections if you try and do that. The takeout is 5 hours away from Flagstaff. We've got to drive back there. We don't get off the river on time. If we have trouble getting space to break all this down and get it loaded on the truck, if the truck were to break down on the way back and you don't make Fairbanks, then all your plans are totally wasted. If you wait till the next day to make your plans to go home or to go somewhere else, it's a much safer and better system. So that's what I require people to do.
You mentioned the possibility of food poisoning. I would imagine that should be avoided at all costs. So what do you have along the lines of sanitation to protect against that?
As any hospital or doctor's office will tell you, hand washing is your best protection. So we have a hand washing station that stays with the toilet in that area. After you're done with the toilet, you wash your hands before you leave there, and you prevent anything from leaving that area. If you're in the kitchen area, we have another hand washing station. Soap, water, sanitizer, and you wash your hands before you go into the kitchen. If you're working with fresh meat or something, you wash your hands before you touch it and after you're done with it. You simply can't be too careful when you have that many people that close together for that period of time in a wilderness situation. You do not want these illnesses and infections getting away on you. So we go to pretty good lengths to sanitize everything. When the dishes are done, not only are they washed in soapy water, rinsed in hot water, they're also dipped in bleach for a few minutes before they're air dried. We take great care to prevent these things. In all the trips that I have done, nobody has ever gotten sick. It doesn't happen a lot, and almost always it's a condition of carelessness. All outfitters are supplying these things. Nobody wants their group or their clients to get sick. It truly ruins your trip.
Are you able to rinse out your clothes once in a while or wash your hair once in a while with safe biodegradable soap, I'm sure?
That is doable. The option you have is the river. It's always the river. Sometimes the river is a nice, beautiful, clear green color. Sometimes it looks more like mud. You can use it in either condition, although you may not get as clean as you think you're going to. I would say that most people, even during the winter, are washing, rinsing off in the river at least once a week. When it's warmer, perhaps several times a day, they'll be jumping in. But the soap comes out, and you can get clean, and you can stay clean fairly easily. We've never been in a situation where they couldn't maintain the standards that they wanted. Maybe their hair was dirty for a couple of days, but we boil up some hot water and they go down the river's edge and they work with each other and they shampoo each other and everybody's happy again. There aren't any issues. There's always time for this to happen. It's not like you're pressed for time and you can't maintain cleanliness.
This is Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. We're talking to Bill Schwager of Soldotna about the logistics of planning a rafting trip down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. He and a group of other Central Peninsula residents did that trip in February, and they'll be doing a slideshow presentation about the trip tonight at 7 at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. On the show right now, we're talking about planning and organizing that trip. Bill, you've covered applying for the permit, getting the gear, scheduling, finding campsites. Do you have other advice for people thinking about doing this trip?
Yeah, I have a lot of advice for people who would like to do this and have never done it before. I'm not even exactly sure where to start, but I'll give it a shot. First off, you really need to want to do this trip. This is not an easy trip. This is true wilderness. Once you commit to the launch at Lee's Ferry, you are truly on your own for the duration of your trip. Outside of your satellite phone, you will have no communication. Don't bring your cell phone. Don't bring your electronic toys. They aren't going to work. This is wilderness in a true sense. You've got to be prepared to deal with the consequences of that. You've got to practice safety, not only for yourself, but for your group at all times. Because you are remote, whatever help you're going to get is hours to days away. The ambulance is not coming, so you just cannot be too careful. And you've got to be comfortable in this situation, or you don't belong out there. It sounds rather harsh to say that, but it's not for everybody. There are dangers out there. There are life-threatening dangers if you're not careful. Most accidents in the Grand Canyon occur on the shore. They do not occur in the water. Most notably are falls, either at the river's edge or when you're off on doing hiking or if you're taking chances climbing. Very, very serious accidents have happened. And the places that these happen may or may not be able to have emergency people come in. The victim may have to transport it several miles down the river before a suitable landing spot can be found for a helicopter, because that truly is the only way out. Communications, even with a satellite phone, is not guaranteed. The canyon walls are steep. You may have to climb these walls to a point that you can get reception, even let anybody know what has happened. It's advisable to have somebody on a trip with some medical experience. Not necessarily a doctor, but at least somebody who is not going to pass out at the sight of blood.
Ooh, yeah, that is always helpful. What else do you look for in a good trip participant?
Probably the one thing I would emphasize to people who have never done a trip like this before is you've got to have people on the trip who are willing to get along. There is nothing worse on a trip than petty bickering. If you can't put aside minor things that you don't like about somebody and still have a good time, then you don't belong on this trip. Because not everybody fits that mold. They have certain ways of doing things that are uncompromising, and these types of things cannot happen on these trips. Once this bickering and fighting starts, it becomes infectious, and pretty soon nobody's having a good time. So it's just extremely important that you pick your people carefully, folks that can get along for 2 weeks at a time, closely confined together, and closely confined and can be often sitting next to each other in the boat for a whole day. So I just can't emphasize that strongly enough, because you're stuck with each other for the duration. There is no getting out.
Yes, that makes for a long couple of weeks. What else?
We touched on having experienced people in the skilled positions. I think that's really important. I've been on trips where a person who's never rowed has done an awesome job, but that's an exception, not the rule, I assure you. This is a very serious whitewater river. This is not like the Kenai River, and it truly will hurt you if you're foolish enough to go where you shouldn't be. You need to be able to recognize the dangers out there and so that you can stay away from them.
Good things to keep in mind.
I'm sure there's lots of other things I could pick, but those are the big ones that come off the top of my head. You got to get along and you got to be safe. I think those are the two big ones, because you just can't emphasize wilderness enough. There is no help out there, not close, not timely. You simply can't take chances. If somebody gets hurt, if somebody gets killed, it pretty much ruins the trip for everybody. It's a very, very traumatic event. Okay. That being said, those things do happen. And sometimes with nothing that you have any control over. These are big waves. I mean, you're looking at mountains of water that might be 15, 20 feet tall. It can be a little rough. I've gone through waves where we have an 18-foot boat, and I've had half of that boat out of the water in the air in front of me, coming over the top of a wave. These are great fun things, but they are physically demanding that way.
Luckily, nothing quite so drastic happened to you guys. I understand there were some challenges and a couple of dunkings, but no one got hurt.
No, it did not. We had our moments, but we got through them. We worked through them, and everybody had a great time. And I haven't heard a single comment from anybody that wouldn't do it again, given the opportunity. And that's probably as good a review of the trip that I could ever ask from anybody. If you're willing to do it again, you had a good time.
And we will hear about it tonight. I understand you won't be able to be there, but your sister, Mary King, and many others are bringing their photos and videos and stories.
I think Mary's got some wonderful pictures for you. I hear that everybody got some really good ones this time. There's some good video coming.
Well, sorry we won't hear from you tonight, but thank you for all the information today. This has been a good introductory course to the logistics of rafting through the Grand Canyon.
I'm sure there are lots of areas that we have either skimmed over or have totally forgotten in this whole process. We could spend hours talking about how these trips are put together and the steps that one needs to go through and all of that.
Of course. You'll never know all of it until you actually do it for yourself. But this has been a good intro to all the things you at least need to think about if you're going to do this.
Exactly. Know what you're getting into. I guess that's the best advice you could give anybody, because this is, like I say, this is not the Kenai River. This is so much farther beyond that that you can't even see it from there. And it's definitely serious, and it demands all the respect that you can give it.
It does. And respect to you for your time and information today.
I hope I've been helpful to you. You too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking today. And if you would like to hear how that trip went, come to the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center tonight at 7 p.m. to see photos and videos and hear stories from the group. Admission is $5 or free for KDLL members. This has been Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Until next time, happy adventures, everybody.